This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Our panel of trumpet writers is ready to discuss the important events of this past week. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
It's good to have you back. Brent has been out of pocket for a couple of weeks as we've started up work on our new archaeological dig in Jerusalem. It began just this past Monday. He's heading up a dozen of our volunteers there. So we're planning to check in with Brent fairly regularly on our Wednesday Trumpet Hour programs. I'd encourage you to tune into those. We're going to start this week in review program talking about Jerusalem news, something of particular interest given the discussion in recent weeks about restarting peace talks between Arabs and Israelis. And that is a speech delivered by Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas this past Sunday. This man is considered a moderate by many Western leaders. He deserves to be the leader of a Palestinian state. He wants peace. The only reason the peace process hasn't worked is because of the Israelis. That's what we hear, supposedly. Well, this speech by Mr. Abbas should put those notions to rest. For this, we'll go straight to Brent.
Yeah, this was a very important speech that Mr. Abbas gave to his general counsel on Sunday, indicating how far away right now we are from any type of peace deal with the Israelis, especially one that would be brokered by the United States. He used it to express his complete distrust in the Trump administration. Vice President Pence will be here. Actually, I think it is. He arrives here on Sunday and is here for a few days. He will not be going to Ramallah. He will not be meeting with Mr. Abbas, because ever since Mr. Trump's decision to call Jerusalem the capital of the state of Israel, Mr. Abbas has boycotted the U.S. administration. And so he spoke a lot about that, but he also just talked a lot about, or a fair bit, about Jewish claims to the land, and talked about how ahistorical they were, at least according to him. He said this, he says, the state of Israel is a colonial enterprise that has nothing to do with Jewishness. The Jews were used as a tool under the concept of the promised land. Call it whatever you want. Everything else has been made up. And so there is a lot of history that he's saying here that has been written in textbooks, the most important one of those being the Bible, that he believes is completely false, and that Jewish heritage in this land doesn't go back thousands and thousands of years. Then he will use the Bible in some cases and talk about the Canaanites and say that he is a descendant of the Canaanites who were there before even Abraham was here. Anyhow, there is this growing push in his rhetoric and the rhetoric of the Palestinians to deny Jewish heritage of the land of Israel, especially of the land in and around Jerusalem. And we are seeing this come out now in almost every one of his speeches. He gave a speech back, I think it was about a month ago, in Turkey for that special summit, very special summit, I forget what they called it, against what Mr. Trump had declared, that Jerusalem was the capital of Israel. And he spent that as well, denying Jewish history here in the land of Israel. This is what he's going to now. It is one of his talking points that he's sticking to.
So can you give us, you gave us maybe one, can you give us some more examples of some of the more extreme statements that he made this past Sunday?
Well, this past Sunday, he, I don't have the whole speech in front of me. This was kind of that main, one main comment that the rest of it was made up, or this biblical history has been made up. That was latched onto by a number of reporters, just because it comes as a long line of statements by Mr. Abbas. Back in 2012, he claimed that they claim that 2,000 years ago the temple existed. I challenge this claim as being so, saying that the Herod's temple that has been documented by historical source after historical source didn't exist. Then he actually, back in 2012, turned his hatred against, or his vitriol against the archaeologists, saying that they are never-ending digging in the city and they are trying to vindicate the Israeli narrative but have failed to do so. Then 2016 says that the Palestinians existed before Abraham, before the Jews were even said to have been there. And what I find interesting is not that the whole speech was dominated by the anti-history rhetoric, but that it is so common now that he will say it in every single speech, that the Jewish history has been lied about. It's something that they push to encourage this narrative that the Israelis deserve to be there, when he claims it's a fabricated truth.
Your response as an archaeologist in Jerusalem.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, not everyone gets the opportunity to dig into the ground, but the more you hear something and the more it's given time in the media, you don't necessarily follow it, but it is a seed that's stuck in your mind. Well, that maybe that history is fabricated, or maybe there isn't as much proof really as the Israelis claim. When I would say there is more proof than what the Israelis claim, because in many cases, the Israeli archaeologists downplay, depending on where they were educated, downplay their history, because their history is also biblical history. So it's connected. And so, you know, digging in the ground just this week, digging in the ground in Jerusalem on the Ophel, which is just in the central part of Jerusalem, just south of the Temple Mount wall. You can throw a stone and hit the Temple Mount wall. We're digging in a layer that's 2,000 years old. This isn't fabricated. And what do we find? We find implements, pottery, artifacts that show the Jewish presence there. There was this artifact that was found this week, made a vessel made out of stone. Why is it made out of stone? Because in and around the temple, if vessels were going to be used, they should be as pure as could be. And pottery is considered to be too impure. And so you find a lot of stone vessels right here around where the temple should be. We found one of them this week. That's not a surprising thing to discover here in Jerusalem, but it matches the historical sources that talk about that's what Jews did 2,000 years ago. Put a spade in the ground in Israel, especially Jerusalem, you dig down far enough and you will find Jewish heritage. That's just a fact. And here we have, as part of this anti-peace agenda, or at least to try and show up the American administration of being so pro-Israeli, he will use this argument that the Jews weren't here 2,000, 3,000 years ago. That is what he's calling for. And here we are, at the same time he's giving that speech, or a day later, we start an excavation in ancient Jerusalem that should put that question beyond any doubt. Here we have the leader of the Palestinian Authority, as you said, held up by the world, esteemed as the world as a moderate, and he is unable to accept a basic truth of history that the Jews were in this land. What are the chances of peace between the two if that can't be agreed upon?
And like you said, this is not just something that is new to this week or even last month's address in Turkey. This is something that he's been saying for years, even decades. He's been denying the Holocaust from the time that he was a scholar. And so it definitely is a known aspect of who he is, and yet we still continue this charade as if he's somebody that could be relied upon within peace negotiations. Can you put it in prophetic context for us, Brent, and give us an idea of where we might look to why this is significant that we're dealing with this kind of an individual in that power position?
Well, I think there's two ways that you can look at this. You could look at this one as being, here we've got a leader that's supposed to work out peace with the Israelis. It's just not going to happen. And that is a prophetic, that's brought out in Bible prophecy, that this peace process, as Hosea talks about, is a wound for Israel. If the world is trying to push Israel towards peace, they need a partner for peace. And this intransigence is not of the peace partner is not going to produce peace. And the Bible talks about Israel having to turn to other people to try and help them broker peace, such as Germany. But you can also just look at it in the prophetic standpoint of of the period we're living in, when our work, and backed by God, has chosen to be a part of this uncovering of history. And really, this Palestinian slight against history that should be well known is really a way of trying to belittle the claims and the of what we find. Whatever we find is going to be based on fact. It's in the ground. We can't hide that. And yet we have a Palestinian leader that's trying to denounce those discoveries before they're even dug up. And what I would do if I was you, I would request Gerald Flory's article, Archaeology Thunders, Behold Your God. And it talks about what's been discovered already in Israel. Again, if you're anti-Jewish history, you're also anti-Bible history. That's why it's important to follow this closely.
Thanks for that, Brent. More movement this week with Europe trying to deal with the threat of immigration from the Middle East and North Africa. This week, the Italian Parliament approved joining a military mission in North Africa aimed at combating the flow of migrants across the Mediterranean. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, Italy has approved on Wednesday beefing up its military in Africa. They're going to increase their military presence in Libya, and they're going to deploy up to 470 soldiers in Niger. It's a moderate step up in both of those locations. They've been bit by bit, you know, we've seen this over the last 2 years or so, Italy bit by bit getting more and more involved in Libya. You know, first, it's their ships patrolling outside Libyan territorial waters. Then they start to be allowed into Libyan territory waters. And then it's, okay, well, we'll have a few Italian troops on the ground. And then now they're beefing that up just a little bit more this week.
Just for clarity here, some of these troops, they're actually moving from elsewhere in the region, from Afghanistan, from Iraq. Maybe you can just help us to understand why it would be significant that we're seeing this shift toward North Africa in particular.
Yeah, North Africa really is taking on more and more importance when it comes to this clash with radical Islam for a couple of important reasons. I mean, first of all, you've got the migrant crisis. So, yes, Afghanistan, Iraq, you know, they're kind of more tangentially important to European powers such as Libya. You know, they're going in to support the US. They're going in to combat terrorism that could potentially lead to an attack. But they're much more directly connected to what's going on in North Africa, because you've got all of these migrants pouring into their borders, causing all of these political problems that we're talking about so often on this show, with anti-immigrant parties rising. So that's one part of the reason. And then you're also seeing radical Islam shift a little as well. The Islamic State just got some significant setbacks in Syria, suffered some very significant defeats over there, and in Iraq, as Iran starts to take over those regions. But they've been increasing their presence inside Libya as well. And you're having some of these Islamist groups shift their attention to North Africa, too. So when you combine those two trends, you're seeing an increasing urgency for Europe to get much more involved in that region.
Put it in prophetic context for us, Richard. What is it about Europe and a particularly extending military missions into this part of the world that interests us?
Yeah, this is a story that has a very direct, very straightforward prophetic context. You can look in Daniel chapter 11, and you can look in, verse 40 talks about a clash between a European king of the north and an Islamist king of the south. And Daniel 11 and verse 43 specifically talks about this king of the north coming into conflict with this king of the south in Libya, in Ethiopia, in Egypt, so in North Africa. So the Bible prophesies specifically of a clash that takes place in these regions. And so what we're seeing right now is this clash building. We're seeing radical Islam, backed in so many cases by Iran, getting an increasing hold in that region. And we're seeing Europe now sit up and take notice. All right, you know, North Africa has always been of key importance to Europe. It's very directly connected to the continent. Whether you go back, say, 2,000 years to the Roman Empire, that was an empire on both sides of the Mediterranean, to just even the 1940s and the way World War II in Europe very quickly spread to battles in North Africa. It's something that's intimately connected to Europe, and so it's logical that that clash would spread there. We've got an article by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flory that talks about both that history, what's going on right now, and that Bible prophecy called Mediterranean Battle Escalating into World War III. That's from the July 2016 Trump print edition. It's a great place to go to learn more about this, and we can include a link to that in the show notes.
Very good. Thank you for that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. A couple of stories about China now, specifically the ways that the Chinese are using information as a tool to further their ambitions. China's been working to improve relations with Cambodia. And the trouble is, the horrifying history that these two countries have, specifically the responsibility China had in empowering the murderous regime of Cambodia's Pol Pot. Well, in the interest of cozying up to China, it looks like Cambodia is now willing not only to bury the hatchet, but also to pretend like China had nothing to do with that history. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this is it's a really interesting story that centers on Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen. Hun Sen has been the leader of Cambodia for about 35 years now, which makes him the longest-serving prime minister in the world and one of the longest-serving leaders in the world. And back in 1979, he was part of a group of Khmer Rouge defectors who were instrumental in overthrowing that brutal communist regime of Pol Pot. So that was an extraordinary accomplishment, really, for Hun Sen. He helped to end one of the most barbaric regimes that ever blighted mankind, responsible for almost 2 million deaths, you know, just terrible atrocities there. And the way that Hun Sen always used to talk about that history, he made sure that everyone knew that Pol Pot's murderous regime had been supported by communist China. Back in 1979, for example, just after that overthrow, Hun Sen wrote, quote, "The barbarous, genocidal regime of the Pol Pot clique was an instrument of Beijing's expansionist policy." And then a decade later, he said, quote, "China is the root of all that is evil in Cambodia." And he said that because China had really been the only power that was supporting Pol Pot. There was no one else supporting that regime. And so it's very clear from Hun Sen's statements that he made in the 70s and 80s and 90s that he knew China was really at the foundation of Pol Pot's regime, and he wanted the world to know that China was to blame. But now Hun Sen is suddenly discussing this history very differently. On January 3rd, there was a documentary broadcast throughout Cambodia about the fall of Pol Pot, and the documentary is built around a lengthy interview with Hun Sen, and China's not mentioned one single time. So the fact that Pol Pot was basically a puppet in the hands of the Chinese communists is totally omitted, and China's part in this brutal history is just being completely erased.
It's quite extraordinary for somebody who has his history, this Hun Sen that you're talking about, who's been kind of a symbol of the opposition against Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge, to be taking the position he is. What do you make of it? Like, what does this say about the influence that China is having over Cambodia right now?
Well, I think it just shows that it is very, very significant, the Chinese influence. And it's forced Hun Sen to make this 180. You have to wonder how his conscience feels about this, because he was so diametrically opposed to all things Chinese. The only way I think that he could be rationalizing it is to say that the support of Pol Pot's regime was done by, you know, Mao Zedong and Deng Xiaoping and those. And maybe he thinks the new wave of Chinese leadership is different. In actual fact, that's not the case at all.
I mean, yeah, we've been talking about just how much, how little daylight there is between the current leader and those that you just mentioned.
Yes, yeah, but it's really over the last several years, and especially just in the last year, Hun Sen has been rapidly moving away from the United States and from democracy, really. Last year, he canceled major joint military drills with America. He kicked a U.S. Navy unit that was there for infrastructure building projects out of the country. He shut down a major U.S.-owned newspaper and two U.S.-run radio programs, and he ended up imprisoning some of the reporters for espionage. And all the while, he's been pushing Cambodia closer and closer to China, taking out billions of dollars in loans from Beijing for development projects, conducting joint military drills with China's People's Liberation Army. And now here he is revising history to exonerate China for its part in that Pol Pot brutality. So it's just really clear that Cambodia under Hun Sen is shifting away from alignment with the U.S. and toward closer alignment with China. And this is a trend that we've discussed with several Asian nations, smaller nations there in Asia, including Thailand, Vietnam, Malaysia, the Philippines as well. These Asian countries see America's decline. They also see China becoming more powerful and more willing to use that power. And so they're just kind of altering their geopolitical alignments and partnerships in response to those shifts.
And in some ways, this particular about face that we're talking about is more dramatic than some of those others that you mentioned, just because of the personalities involved.
That's right. Yes, in Cambodia, it really does seem like a sharp 180 from you know, severe antagonism and hostility between China and Cambodia to camaraderie, and it's happened very quickly.
But it does align with what biblical prophecy says and what we've expected to happen in Asia.
That's right. Yes, the Bible says in the end time, an era will start that the Bible terms the times of the Gentiles. Jesus Christ himself used this term. You can see that in Luke 21. And if you look at the context, it's clear that these times of the Gentiles occur after a shift in global power takes place, moving power away from America and toward a German-led Europe, and also toward an Asian bloc that's led by Russia and China. So Hun Sen, his moving of Cambodia away from the U.S. and toward China, is leading to that biblically prophesied era called the times of the Gentiles. And Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has a very powerful article from our July 2014 print edition. It's called What Are the Times of the Gentiles? And it explains this passage in Luke and all the other related Bible passages and just shows how they are being fulfilled today.
Well, thanks for that, Jeremiah. We'll go straight to a second story about China. This regards the ways that the Chinese government is pouring billions of dollars into a propaganda campaign to spread an airbrushed view of the country. And a whole lot of this money is going to hundreds of primary and secondary schools and colleges in the United States. Could your children be receiving information direct from the Chinese Communist Party? For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is one of those headlines that when you first see it reported, it almost sounds kind of mundane, but then just the more you dig into it, the more shocking it becomes. And it mostly concerns the establishment of what are called Confucius centers around the world. These are financed directly by the Communist Party of China. There's about 500 of them in universities around the world, 100 of those universities in the United States. And then about 400 grade school Confucius centers to boot. And it's mostly about, or at least on the surface, it's mostly about teaching Chinese language, but then also Chinese culture, things like feng shui and some of these other Eastern religious practices. And probably most important for the Chinese Communist Party, is China foreign policy objectives, teaching college students that China has a moral right to occupy Tibet, that Taiwan is not really an independent nation. The Tiananmen Square massacre either never happened or was way overblown by Western media. And the hope is that this is basically a way for China to project soft power, that the next generation of leaders in America and other countries will grow up thinking that Taiwan is part of China and Tibet there's no human rights violations that they need to be concerned about there. And even hopefully have accepted some either Confucian or Maoist principles in their own life. It's actually quite similar to what the Soviet Union used to do in the Cold War with the student exchanges, sending Soviet students to U.S., U.S. students to Soviet Union, in hopes that they would foster better relations between both nations, but also in hopes that they would accept more of the communist ideology here in America.
I guess the difference is that when the Soviets were doing this, they were kind of a more surreptitious about it, or they were trying to do it without really being detected. Whereas what China is doing, they're being quite open about it, aren't they?
Right, and the Soviets were more trying to sow like race wars and civil strife in America as well. That there's not an indication that China necessarily wants that so much as it's just like a projection of soft power, that if we're going to be the next, it's just like America projects Hollywood movies and Coca-Cola all over the world. If China's going to be a superpower, they need to project their culture.
But if they're putting billions of dollars into this, you'd have to think that there would be at least the potential for this to be more than just a little bit of maybe a soft-pedaled version of China, that there would be other dangers associated with it as well, wouldn't you?
Yeah, well, there's definitely been a lot of reports out there from the Heritage Center and other security analysts pointing out the danger of espionage as well. When you have professors coming here directly from communist China, you have institutes at U.S. universities directly funded by the Chinese government, that the capacity for taking research being done at these university labs and other things like that, industrial secrets, and sending it back to China would be easy. There's not necessarily evidence that that's happened already, but it's definitely not something that would be difficult to do, and a threat that security analysts have been putting out there as one of the dangers of letting a center like this operate at a U.S. university.
Well, the United States just doesn't tend to view these types of activities as being threatening. Generally speaking, it seems like we're quite comfortable with foreign nations, even those that are provably, demonstrably against American interests, working against American interests in other arenas. We just kind of assume the best. That tends to be the way that we think.
Right. And a lot of American educators and stuff like that, like you say, they are really, they're maybe devoted to spreading information and spreading culture around the world, and assuming that everyone else is just as devoted to those goals as they are, and make it sound a little suspicious that maybe a nation like Russia or China would be sending people over here to steal industrial secrets or implement Eastern philosophies in the minds of the next generation of students. But there is definitely good evidence that that has happened in many cases.
I was recently just looking at a prophecy in Isaiah 2, verse 6 in the New King James Version says this: "For you have forsaken your people, the house of Jacob, because they are filled with Eastern ways. They are soothsayers like the Philistines, and they're pleased with the children of foreigners." Pretty strong prophecy. I guess there's a lot of different ways that you could look at that, but this certainly seems to be one of those fulfillments of that verse.
Yeah, that is actually really interesting, in that the fact that for the past 50, 60 years, it has been primarily China and Russia that has been really influencing a lot of the ways our universities are going. I brought a similar verse in Hosea 7, verses 8 through 10, talking about Israel being mixed together with foreign peoples and their strength being sapped away because of it. And for this story, actually, for more information, I was going to just really try to point our listeners to the He Was Right booklet. It's about all the different prophecies God used Mr. Armstrong to proclaim to the world that have happened or are currently happening. But there's a particular chapter in there entitled "The Communist Infiltration of America Was Prophesied," that really points to that verse in Hosea and highlight some of the things Mr. Armstrong had said about America even becoming not just mixed up with foreign immigrants, but mixed up ideologically with foreigners. At the time, he was mostly talking about Soviet professors coming up and bringing atheism and other philosophies that were popular in the East at the time to America. And now it's kind of taken that another major Eastern communist power. China is the one that's kind of, maybe even more than Russia, fulfilling that role in terms of sending professors to the United States to teach us of the Eastern ways. But it is definitely something that has been going on for a long time. And as that article explained Mr. Armstrong had predicted that that would be sapping America of its industrial, military, and even moral strength.
Well, go check it out on thetrumpet.com. He was right. The chapter, The Communist Infiltration of America, was prophesied. Thanks for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we'll talk about German police uncovering Iranian spies in Germany, an assassination in Kosovo that could reignite violence in the Balkans, more evidence of authoritarianism in the Philippines, and the 38 minutes during which Hawaiians thought they were about to be hit by a North Korean nuclear bomb. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
We were talking in the first half of the program about a prophecy in Daniel 11 describing a major confrontation between a radical Islamic Middle Eastern power and a European power. And if you put that prophecy in context with other prophecies, you see that the leading nations involved in that confrontation are Iran and Germany. So we at the Trumpet track the increase in tensions between these two nations in particular, and there's plenty of evidence that we have to look at seeing these tensions rise. This week, German police raided several targets that were conducting surveillance on targets in Germany, Israeli and Jewish targets, and apparently they were operating on orders from Iran's secret service. For this story, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this is something that it seems that the Iranians have been doing for quite some time, using different locations inside Europe to gather intelligence on Jewish groups, Israelis, synagogues, and for potential targets in the future. And this time they've been trying to do this in Germany, and the German government has decided that it's going to crack down on it. Although there were no arrests at this point, they are seeking 10 individuals that are related to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, who are trying to gather intelligence against Israelis to perpetrate attacks, terrorist attacks within Germany against Jewish and Israeli targets.
How active are we aware is Iran within Germany, and like, what does this represent in terms of the scope of Iranian activities there?
Well, we know that the Iranians are active there, not just the Iranians, but also their proxies. It's interesting because inside Germany, you have the Hezbollah terrorist group, which answers to Iran, that is not actually illegal. And even back in 2012, I think this was the last time the count was done, but there is about 950 known Hezbollah members inside Germany. And they're there acting on behalf of Hezbollah. They might not be involved in terrorist attacks or terrorist activities, but I'm sure some are involved in the planning, the future planning of those. Of course, Hezbollah is both a terrorist entity and a political entity, and yet the Germans have not decided to outlaw that. And so it's no real wonder that you have the Iranians using those resources inside Germany to perpetrate attacks against Israelis. This has happened in the past. I believe it was in 1992 that a synagogue was struck by a Hezbollah or Iranian-affiliated terrorist planned by the support of the IRGC against a Jewish target, a synagogue. I think four was killed. Then we also have the fact that the German intelligence agency back in 2015 and reconfirmed last year that Iran has made several attempts on its own soil in Germany to maintain nuclear-related equipment and technologies that would be breaking the Iran deal. And so what I think is interesting about this is that you have Iran acting covertly to further their own interests inside Germany, and it's now that the German government has decided that it's going to crack down on it. Will we see the German government follow the United States, the United States' lead? It's designating Hezbollah and also the IRGC as a terrorist group. I don't know, but if these type of events continue, or if they go out of their way, the Germans, to start targeting Iranian-backed groups inside Germany, maybe that maybe this shows that they're hardening their stance towards Iran.
So you're saying that these activities have been going on for quite some time. You referenced an event back in 1992. There are also in this Jerusalem Post report, it's talking about activities going back to 2007. German authorities conducted criminal investigations of 22 cases of alleged Iranian espionage over a 10-year period. Almost as many as there were investigations into Russian espionage cases, and nearly 40 attempts in 2016 that Iran made to purchase missile and atomic technology. So a lot of this has been going on. Germany's been aware of it. But what you're saying is what we saw this week with this raid, we also had the German foreign ministry reprimanding the Iranian ambassador last month. That this is uniquely stringent in terms of Germany's response to it.
Yeah, I think we are seeing, like, it's no, Iran has been doing this for a number of years, as you've shown. But now we do see the German response coming on a little stronger, going at the Iranian ambassador. You even inside Germany, you even have calls from different Jewish groups right now for Germany to expel the Iranian ambassador. This is a big move diplomatically if the Germans actually do this. And so while these may look like little events and really, I mean, we're talking of the Middle East and we're choosing to narrow our focus just on this. We highlight it because it's prophetically significant. We highlight it because we know that Germany is going to see Iran as a threat, the biggest threat in the Middle East, and they are going to be mobilized to do something about it. So we have to see, or we will see, in world events, Germany start to do something. Are we starting to see this change inside Germany now in the post-nuclear deal world where it is starting to act on some of those things that it's known has been going on for years? We expect this to increase as time goes on.
I'd certainly encourage listeners to go to thetrumpet.com and check under the trends column at the top, the tab at the top that says trends. We have an article that says why the Trumpet watches Iran and Europe heading for a clash of civilizations. It gives a pretty detailed explanation of why it is that we're so concerned about this rising tensions between Iran and Germany in particular. It puts it in its prophetic context and shows how the Bible has said that this is what's going to happen. Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flory's drawn a lot of attention to this over the years. So go check that article out. We do appreciate that, Brent. On the morning of January 16th this year, a top leader of Kosovo's Serb minority, when he showed up for work at the office, he was shot at least five times, and he died at the hospital shortly thereafter. It was a shocking assassination, and it could reignite violence in the unstable Balkans. For this story, we'll go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Oskar Ivanovic, he was shot dead. And at this point, that's about all there is that's known of the story. They don't know who was responsible yet. He was a moderate, he was known in Serbia as a moderate Serbian politician. So to give some of the backstory, of course, Kosovo broke away from Serbia some time ago, but as with all of these breakaway regions, Kosovo, the whole region of Kosovo is majority Albanian, but there are significant pockets of Kosovo itself that are majority Serbian. And they were not at all happy to be part of this broken away area. They, you know, there were various different extremes, say, and Ivanovic was known as one of the moderates, one of the ones that kind of had the policy of, okay, we don't like what's happened with Kosovo breaking away. We don't think we should recognize it, but we want to work with the Kosovar government and we to some extent, and you know, let's kind of be pragmatic about this. So he was shot, and then now nobody really knows who to blame. Kosovo is saying that it was probably extreme Kurds, extreme Serbs. Serbia is kind of looking more towards it being Kosovar Albanians and links to, say, some of those Kosovar militant or terrorist groups from the early 90s. You've got both sides wanting to investigate, Kosovo saying, well, this is under our jurisdiction, we're going to investigate, Serbia saying, we want to investigate, Kosovo saying, no, we're not going to let you. And then this comes amidst a general background of escalation. And so just a few days before he was shot, the U.S. State Department issued a travel warning for violence in North Kosovo, warning U.S. citizens to stay out of the area. Serbia has asked the U.S. to share the intelligence that led to that assessment. I don't know whether they've had that yet. And then this is an area that's just kind of been simmering even all the way through 2017. There have been various different tensions. They've not really gained enough attention to pop up in our nightly news, but there have been all kinds of these different tensions over there. For example, the latest one comes from Macedonia recognizing there's a kind of a fight going on in there about Macedonia recognizing Albanian as a second language of the state. And of course, with Kosovo being majority Albanian and the Serbs not being a big fan of the Albanians, that has kind of stirred the pot in the whole region. You've got EU membership on the table as well as another thing. So this is a major event in the background or amidst this background of rising tensions overall.
Well, this is it is quite extraordinary seeing something like this dramatic happen in this particular area. Obviously, there have been famous assassinations in the past that have led to some pretty substantial problems in that area. And even more broadly, we've talked a lot about just how much the Balkans, it's kind of this this battleground between European interests, German interests, and even lately Russian interests. How does what we saw happen this week fit into that context?
Right. So the Balkans is this area, like you say, it's where three civilizations basically meet. You've got Catholic Europe, you've got Orthodox Russia in the east, and then you've got, you know, very strong Muslim populations, generally from the time of the Ottomans, in there as well. And that's why, because it encompasses those three civilizations, that's why it's so often a crisis point or a trigger point or something involved in the conflict of these three. In more recent times, this was an area under Yugoslavia that could have been a really strong Russian ally, right, you know, on the borders of Italy, at the heart of Europe. Germany led the way in getting that broken up in the early 1990s. That's something that has been to Europe's enormous benefit. I mean, imagine the tensions with Russia, except with this massive nation right next to Italy that's on Russia's side. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of left that whole area a bit of a festering sore, with a whole load of tension still there. So, you know, now we're seeing a potential flare up. We've seen basically for 2-3 years, even there's been the potential for a flare up. And I think what it comes down to is, does Russia want it to flare up? I think they want to kind of keep reminding Europe, keep reminding Germany that there's a problem here, that Russia could really use this to hurt Europe if they wanted to, if they really wanted to stir up trouble. Now, I'm definitely not saying Russia's behind that assassination. I have no idea who's behind that assassination. All I'm saying is that for years, this whole area has been incorporated in power plays between Europe, the Muslim world, and Russia. So you've got a major event here that could provide either, say, radical Islam or Russia to take advantage of and kind of continue those tensions with Europe. Maybe that will be a catalyst for Germany to keep talking to Russia. But it's certainly, because of that, its strategic importance and that history, it is an important area to keep an eye on. We have our free booklet, Germany's Conquest of the Balkans. That's a great place to get an understanding of this kind of complicated region. And that really explains Germany's interest there and how this area in the past has really exposed Germany's ambition and clout in the world. So you can go and read that, and perhaps we could see more conflict between Germany and Russia, or even collusion between Germany and Russia in that area from that here on out.
All right. Well, we appreciate that, Richard. We'll move on. We talked in the first half about China spreading propaganda. We have another story now from Asia on the control of information, this one from the Philippines. President Rodrigo Duterte has been criticized a lot in the Philippine press. He's fired back a lot of criticism of his own. Well, this week he went a lot further than just criticizing the press. He shut one source down. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the name of this news site that the Philippine government shut down is called Rappler, and they employ about 100 people, and they've often printed stories that are quite critical of President Duterte's war on drug users and drug dealers, and they've often pointed out that elements of this drug war are unconstitutional. And Rappler's also pointed out other sort of authoritarian aspects of Duterte's rule. And so on Monday, President Duterte's government issued an order to silence this publication. The government says the reason they issued that order is because Rappler had violated a rule that limits ownership of media outlets strictly to Filipinos. But Rappler maintains that those are false charges and that no foreigners have any ownership shares in the company or any role in its operations. And so they say they're being unfairly targeted only because they've been critical of the government. And they say that this is just a move straight out of a dictator's playbook designed to silence opposition and stifle dissent.
Duterte's he's done a lot of things that show this. We've talked about this whole rise of authoritarianism in many countries, and particularly many Asian countries, and he's right at the heart of it. And this really is kind of right in keeping with that trend.
Yes, that's right. Yes, we actually just published a whole issue of the Philadelphia Trumpet that discusses this trend that we're seeing really globally right now, of just a return to authoritarianism in many nations. It's happening in many nations in Asia and Eastern Europe especially right now. And our executive editor, Mr. Stephen Fleury, has an article in that issue. It's called The New Strongman Age. And in that article, he says, quote, "It's one of the most stunning reversals of history. For nearly two centuries, the dominant geopolitical trend in the world was the spread of democratic, free societies. The British Empire led the way in the 19th century. The United States did it during the 20th century. This century will be totally different. The dominant trend thus far has been the rise of authoritarian strongmen." And so this issue of the Trumpet, it also specifically talks about how suppressing the press is how most authoritarian, you know, it's one of those steps that many leaders that would like to, you know, assert more authoritarian powers end up taking. And they often view free media as a threat to their power. We've seen that in Shinzo Abe's Japan. We've seen it in Vladimir Putin's Russia. And now we're seeing similar moves in Rodrigo Duterte's Philippines. So I think it is an important trend to keep an eye on.
All right. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. We'll go now for our final story to Hawaii. An extraordinary blunder this week had Hawaiians scrambling in fear for over a half hour. It shows you just how tense times have become, how much fear there is in today's climate, particularly with respect to the relations with North Korea. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yes, last Saturday at 8:07 in the morning, people with smartphones across Hawaii received a message from the government saying, "Ballistic missile threat inbound to Hawaii. Seek shelter immediately. This is not a drill." And so for about 38 minutes, I mean, you can see some of the, you can go see some, like they have some videos on YouTube and stuff like that that shows the reaction of people crying, people running, people stocking up on supplies, looking for shelter after they'd got this text from the government, until about 38 minutes after the text, they were finally able to get like a "my bad" text come back. It's like, no, this was either a computer or an employee error. There is no missile threat. You can go back about your lives. And so there have been a lot of analysts pointing out just how tense the situation is. I mean, with some of the rhetoric going back and forth between North Korea and the United States, this text was pretty believable to the people who received it, that a power like North Korea may have launched a nuclear missile at Hawaii, and they had to seek shelter immediately. So it does highlight the tension, but I thought another interesting angle to this that hasn't gotten as much media attention is they, I know the local Catholic churches in the area have reported a huge spike in people going to confessions after this warning, and churches across the area have reported like a huge spike in church attendance after this warning. And it almost kind of reminds you of the...
You mean not within the 38 minutes, but even
No, with the obviously 38 minutes you're running and crying and looking
not
for
running
shelter,
to the confessional. But just it just kind of made them realize, wow, you know, this really is real. Maybe the next time won't be a drill.
Right. It reminds you of kind of like what it was like after the 9/11 terrorist attack, right, for maybe 1 week, maybe if you're really devout, 2 weeks. people start going back to church and spending time with their families, and because they realize this is real. And it's kind of sad, actually, but it is something in the human condition you see in all of us, is that you're just really hard-headed, and it takes a lot to get your attention. In this case, as I even take like the threat of the island you live on being blown up by a nuclear bomb is what it takes to get you to start examining your life and trying to look for answers, as if is my relationship with God what it should be. And we have a booklet that our editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has written entitled Zechariah, the Sign of Christ's Imminent Return. And there's one of the chapters in there that's got a very strong title. It's called Only Nuclear Bombs Bring Repentance. There's a section from that chapter where it says, it's going to take a nuclear holocaust to get the nations of Israel to repent. How dangerously self-willed human nature is. And then it quotes some verses from Zechariah just saying that you should listen to the prophets and the warnings and the teachings they give you. But it does show something like this, this kind of time that highlights this in a really real example, that it's amazing how much it takes to get people's attention sometimes.
Yeah, that really is an excellent point. That is definitely our tendency as human beings, is to ignore a lot of warnings or warning signs or, you know, alarming tidbits that come along, that we want to dismiss them and return to life as normal as rapidly as we possibly can. But it does take something really serious in order to jolt us out of the complacency that we tend to fall into. And even when that does happen, it doesn't tend to last for very long. You can see why the intensity of those warnings would have to increase, or even the punishment that would befall us before people would actually make a major turn in their lives. And it is sad.
Right, because it's obviously, if you have a loving God, wants to, just like a loving parent wants to punish your children or allow their children to suffer as least as possible to get them to actually turn their lives around. But the Bible's full of prophecies about, well, like as the Zechariah booklet said, a nuclear holocaust. So apparently that is the least common denominator of punishment that will get the world as a whole to turn back to God and listen to his ways of life.
Quite extraordinary. We appreciate that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to all the articles and the booklets that we discussed today, including that Zechariah booklet that Andrew was just talking about. And let me know what you thought of the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Pleasure to be here.
Good to be here.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Alexander Hislop. There is this great difference between the works of men and the works of God, that the same minute and searching investigation which displays the defects and imperfections of the one brings out also the beauties of the other. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.